with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Agnes calls any of you looking for me, say you haven't heard. She doesn't know I'm back here. I may have to whisper the entire program. See, I pulled a Ferris Bueller. I put a bunch of pillows underneath the bedclothes and left a little recorded loop on the phone. It sounds like me snoring. It sounds like me snoring because it is me snoring. Or at least trying to convincingly sound like I'm snoring. She doesn't know. Shh. I'll be grounded for the rest of my life if she catches me. Well, hello, dear. How are you? I thought you reserved those for the children.
Oh, no. We should.
Rats! Busted!
Heard you confessing.
Do I get to stay and play with my friends, honey? Okay, thank you. God, I hate it when she does that living inside my skull thing. Ugh, it's creepy, I tell you, creepy. But we'll get through this. It is Monday, and I did take Friday off, and no, I am not fully recovered. I am nowhere near fully recovered. My doctor would probably also be something less than happy if he knew what I was doing right now. So we won't tell him either, okay? This is, day, I don't know what, of no real solid food to speak of. But apparently starvation and Cipro seems to be good for the soul, or what ails you, or whatever. So I'm feeling a little bit better, and I've sat and I've just watched too much lunacy all weekend long. You know, how can I stay away from the microphone when the inmates appear to have solidified their hold on the asylum, when it would appear that the right-wing monkeys have taken control of the monkey house and are flinging poo all over all and sundry. And this is, and I'm expected to just sort of lay there in bed and convalesce? Not freaking hardly. I didn't sign up to lay on my butt. And missing Friday was weird enough. I feel like I've been gone for a month of Sundays. So hopefully we'll have some sort of a meaningful program this evening. That's my goal anyway. It will be may periodically be interrupted by things like this. Hold on. Yeah, you didn't want that. I don't know where the sneezing comes from, but no, I'm feeling better enough to get behind the microphone, and when I'm good enough to get behind the microphone, I'm good enough to be here. So let's hope that it cross your fingers. I'm still sort of supposed to stay in the house, not supposed to go anywhere, do anything, and I've been good about that, but I just don't have the kind of good in me to stay away from this, which this thing which I've been doing for these years, and which I have enjoyed and loved and been more passionate about doing than any other thing I've ever done in my life. Plus, you know, there's a week coming up where I will not be on the air. It'll be 6 days away from the microphone. And part of the whole lay low and recuperate thing has been to make sure that I'm well enough to well and thoroughly enjoy the Progressive Voices cruise. Packing proceeds apace here. And we are all terribly, terribly excited. I'm going through all my cameras and making sure that I've got all the data cards for the digital cameras are blank, and making a list of what to take, and yeah. So the excitement is palpable. Marty knew that to which I, yeah. Time to barf up that lung. One of the great lines from Ferris Bueller. Next time through, I'm going to have to barf up a lung. But it, more than any, it just, it, lunacy, absolute, unmitigated lunacy has ruled the day ever since I signed off on Thursday. It's been downright unpleasant. I think it was, I can't even remember what day anymore, but there's just been stuff rolling in that could not possibly be just left on the shelf pending something besides More and Monday, because that is, after all, what it is. And you know what? We got More ands on our side and More ands on the other side. And as usual, there are far more More ands on their side than there are ours. But I couldn't, while watching the glorious triumph of the Pittsburgh Steelers last night over the New York Jets. Sorry, Jets fans. I'm just a Steelers fan. There's no getting around it. You knew it. You know it. And Marty and I exchanged in a Facebook comment, I'm rooting for the Steelers. I'm rooting for the people of Pittsburgh. I'm rooting for a really great town with a really great team with a long and historic tradition that darned well deserves it. That's why I'll be rooting for Pittsburgh. Ben Roethlisberger has no part in why I am I'm hoping that the Steelers get their seventh Super Bowl ring. Yeah, it used to be one for the thumb, and then it was one for the, and now it's like they're looking for like toe jewelry, which is cool. So I'll be rooting for the Steelers, but not necessarily for Ben Roethlisberger. For people like, for people like Troy Polamalu. A guy who appears to be a genuinely decent soul. And for them to be playing the Packers in the Super Bowl, well, you can't get much more old school than that, can you? Two classic old NFL franchises pre-expansion, and they're going to go and play in Jerry Jones's house in Dallas, where, if there is any justice and any deity whatsoever, his own Cowboys will never, ever, ever play. And John from Poughkeepsie and I were exchanging emails as well, talking about what a cool Super Bowl this could be. And I noted that this has also got to be fun because it sticks a big old finger in the for-profit media's eye. Because you just know that Fox already had everything lined up for the battle between the Big Apple and the Second City. It's the Jets versus the Bears. You know, two great big humongous media markets, big profit potential, big interest, and instead they get two so-called small market teams, Pittsburgh and Green Bay. To which I say, suck it, Fox. And I mean that sincerely. But it was while watching all of that that I did leave out Coach Tomlin, who is a class act, who, yes, I would like to see him get his second ring. That would be a beautiful thing by me. But while watching all this unfold, I had my Twitter account open and watched the curious story of Jane Hampshire's attempt to make publicity on the back of Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning is a young man who lives in hell right now. Not charged with any crime under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Well, maybe he's charged with it. But he has certainly not been formally charged or scheduled for court-martial. But he is kept in solitary confinement for 23 out of every 24 hours of every day. And it is inhuman. It is inhumane. It is also par for the course for the United States military. Technically, the UCMJ contains a presumption of innocence. Practically, that is a nullity. Because the military is an authoritarian, rule-oriented structure. And violations of rules are not smiled upon. So Bradley Manning is living a hellish existence right now in the brig at the Marine base at Quantico, Virginia. So what did Jane Hampshire do? Well, on a Sunday, when there is no one in authority at the base to receive it, she decided she was going to take a petition containing 42,000 signatures asking for the humane treatment of Bradley Manning to the Quantico Marine base. Huh? Yeah, me either. And in so doing, she went there in a vehicle for which she could not prove legitimate proof of insurance and which had expired license plates on it. Bizarre. Bizarre. You know? Yeah, it sort of makes it necessary to crank this stuff up. Step right up! Hurry, hurry, hurry! It's Moran Monday on the Horn! Get your program, and this is the program where you can... Otherwise, you can't tell the Morans without a program. You'll be needing this program specifically for that purpose. It is Moran Monday on the Horn, and you will see, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, kiddies and cousins, you will see Morans beyond your comprehension, Morans beyond your belief. No one will be admitted to the Moran Monday exhibition behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas after the first 5 minutes. Moran Monday on the Horn. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. Get away from the candy apples. Come away from the cotton candy. You neither want to see how it's made nor actually ingest that god-awful chili dog from that questionable, dubious hot dog water over there along the Midway. Get right over here, get your ticket, and come right inside. Moran Monday on the Horn. Yeah. It's the Marines, for Christ's sakes. It's not the Little Sisters of the Poor. But then again, I don't have a lot of regard for Jane Hampshire. And the fact that she would pull a publicity stunt like this on the back of someone suffering in almost total solitary confinement is, to me, disgusting. I read the news coverage about it, and then I read her press release, and the comments that followed it were just eye-crossingly strange. And she said they were detained. But she got out. Detained. It's like the Princess Bride. That word she keeps using. I don't think it means what she thinks it means. When you've been detained by a Marine MP, by God, you know you've been detained. And you frequently don't get out for a while to be able to issue snarky press releases. I mean, if you were going to do something like deliver a bunch of petitions, wouldn't you want to make sure that you had everything in order so that you couldn't, they couldn't make, use a trumped-up charge or some other charge to delegitimize the heroic work that you were doing, like delivering a 42,000-signature petition? Yeah, that's what I thought. But no. Because after all, this was about publicity for Jane Hampshire and not anything good for Bradley Manning. So there's one nominee. Eesh. Morans. But we have, like I said, we have more right-wing morans than we do left-wing morans. And one of them, most assuredly, has to be Justice Clarence Slappy Thomas. You remember Coke Can Clarence, right? It turns out there are these really apparently inconvenient for Justice Thomas little things called canons of judicial ethics. And they say things like a judge shall avoid the appearance of impropriety. Not a judge shall avoid impropriety, a judge shall avoid the appearance of impropriety. You know, it's called by some the Caesar's wife standard. Caesar's wife must be above reproach. It's not enough for Caesar's wife to be good, she must also appear to be good and never give the appearance of being anything but good. And apparently that rule is good enough for all the other judges in the land, but there is apparently written in some sort of ink that only repiglic and right-wing conservative teabagging justices can read. A little asterisk that is followed by the letters that we know so well, I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. It's okay if you're a Republican. Because see, Justice Thomas has this little, well, he's got a couple of problems, but he has this one particular problem. And it was exposed in the Los Angeles Times. And it's worth taking time for because, does this qualify as moran? Only generally. Because this is just plain old-fashioned, mean-spiritedly dishonest. See, there's this code of conduct for United States judges. That's where the invisible ink is. And it speaks rather clearly to things like the appearance of impropriety. It speaks rather clearly to financial dealings. Except apparently it doesn't speak to financial dealings in which Clarence Thomas is involved. Now, you see, federal judges, are required, unless they're Supreme Court judges, because the Supreme Court judges have exempted themselves from many of the ethical rules that govern every other federal judge in the United States. You know, those code of conduct for United States judges. Yeah, the people like Slappy Thomas say that really, I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. They said that. Because it turns out that for the last 5 years, according to the Los Angeles Times, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2007, yeah, that's 5 years, Slappy's wife, Virginia, who is a frothing-at-the-mouth right-wing weirdo, well, over those 5 years, she cleared a nice, comfortable, and I'm comfortably well off, comfortable $686,589 from, come on, who else? The Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation reviewed the disclosures and IRS records of, or Common Cause reviewed the Heritage Foundation's IRS records. And that's where the Virginia Thomas money showed up. Because, again, Slappy hadn't disclosed it as he should have. There's a box, you see, on Supreme Court financial disclosure forms. And the little box, there's several little boxes, under the topic spousal non-investment income. We're talking about the income that a spouse makes that is not derived from ownership of securities, bonds, equity positions, that kind of stuff. Spousal non-investment income has its own little box. And Slappy, for 5 years, Slappy checked the box that said none. None. That's more of that right-wing math made easy. You know, where $686,589 equals none.
Well, son, if you're not dealing in seven digits, that ain't really any kind of walking around folding money for no Republican, you understand?
None. $686,589 equals none. Add Jesus and it would pass tests in Texas. 5 years. None. Now, Mrs. Slappy has also been active, according to the LA Times story, in a group called Liberty Central. She founded that organization her own little old self. Because she was going to restore the founding principles of limited government and individual liberty. Which apparently includes individual liberty not to disclose assets and income. Yeah, I bet you thought I was just talking about 2003 to 2007, didn't you? No, not so much.
That's 2003, 2004, 2006.
Yeah, that's 5 years. Add year 2009. That's the year that Slappy Thomas also checked none on his disclosure box where it says spousal non-investment income. That's also the year that Common Cause contends that Liberty Central paid Mrs. Slappy a salary of some unknown amount. So, there you have it. That's pretty dodgy. Can you imagine if this House of Representatives, now controlled by the teabaggers, knuckle-walking, house-helmet-wearing, oatmeal-drooling, mouth-breathing teabaggers, can you imagine the absolute spit-hissy fit they would have if it turned out that Justice Ginsburg was checking none while her husband was out there, say, drawing a salary from People for the American Way or the ACLU? Glenn Beck would already have done a 3-hour exposure on why Elizabeth Ginsburg's husband needs to be gunned down like a dog in the streets. Right? Because, I mean, that's what Glenn Beck does. We have current proof of how Glenn Beck operates. You know, it was Thursday night when I played you the clip of Glenn Beck saying you're going to have to shoot them in the heads. That was you he was talking about, progressive liberal activists. You're going to have to shoot them in the heads. It doesn't matter that he was telling Democratic members of Congress that. It really doesn't matter as long as he gets shoot them in the heads out there, again, for his incredibly well-armed to the teeth, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, house-helmet-wearing, oatmeal-drooling followers. there would be impeachment hearings yesterday if a deemed liberal Supreme Court justice's spouse was bringing down $686,539. I'm sorry, that's pretty close. I wasn't even looking at it at the time. $686,589 from a liberal think tank. The subpoenas would be flying out of Daryl Issa's office so fast that they would be invisible to the naked eye. But don't look for any subpoenas to land on Slappy Thomas's desk. Because, see, being a right-winger, he can... Well, he just... They've got a right to that money, and we're just being nosy little liberals for wanting them to follow the rules. Rules are for people who cannot be trusted, and clearly Slappy and Mrs. Slappy can be trusted. So there's that little bit. Of course, I would be remiss if I were to note the fact that I was absolutely, well, I was sitting there in a drug-induced haze on Friday night, getting to do something that I seldom do, and that is to, I was like, hey, wait, Countdown's on. I can watch Countdown live for a change. Click. And I watch, and I watch, and I watch, and I watch. And then I hear what you, and then I see and hear what you saw and heard. This will be the last Countdown. I'll explain in a minute. And just immediately, I was hit by this great big giant wave of what the, and a profound urge to get off the apparently too powerful for my own good medication. Because it had apparently reached the point where it was making me hallucinate that Keith Olbermann had just said that that was going to be his last Countdown. The only problem being, because, I mean, see, I was afraid that the Limbaugh sickness had already caught up with me after just, you know, 4 or 5 pills. I'm scared of that crap. But it turns out it wasn't the drugs. The walls didn't start breathing. The ceiling didn't turn to paisley. And in fact, Keith Olbermann said goodbye. The first thing that came to mind was, well, that was quick. Comcast gets to buy NBC Universal, and first guy out the door is Keith Olbermann. So immediately I ran and read the New York Times coverage, which announced that Comcast has said it had absolutely nothing to do with Keith Olbermann leaving MSNBC. And I read those words with the same degree of credulity that, I don't know, that you read in a story in which Al Capone claims that he was just a simple businessman who had nothing to do with, you know, the illicit liquor business in Chicago. Oh, Jim, that's a good one. IRS what? Leona Helmsley Thomas. Woo! But no, it turned out that Keith Olbermann was really gone. And there's been a lot of a lot of speculation. Anderson Cooper, said that evening that Keith Olbermann was highly controversial. Well, he was only highly controversial to the people who hated him for calling them out. And so then everybody, hey, wait, Rachel's going to be on Real Time with Bill Maher in a little bit. Maybe she'll say something. And she did. She said, we were all surprised and I know nothing. So, you know, speculate away. But I'll tell you this much, and Robert Perry over at Consortium News picked up on this in a hurry, and it was reposted at Alternet. I saw it there. He picked up on it in an absolute New York second. What the overall meaning of the Olbermann departure was. And I think he had a very good point. It was a column called The Disappearance of Keith Olbermann. And in the lead to the story, Robert Perry, who has written probably more effectively and more accurately on the lack of will to build and counter right-wing media dominance by the so-called left, better than anybody else. Robert Perry wrote, Keith Olbermann's abrupt departure from MSNBC should be another wake-up call to American progressives about the fragile foothold that liberal-oriented fare now has for only a few hours on one corporate cable network. Well, amen to that, Robert Perry. And, of course, it comes with the fact that it's almost impossible to imagine that relationship between MSNBC and Keith Olbermann could have become so toxic that he would feel it necessary to bug out. While at the same time, even though the likes of Glenn Beck are big money losers at Fox, they keep broadcasting. And at the very foundational level, that's because the right wing understands the necessity of getting its message out far more than our side does, and what I fear worst, ever will. Because Rupert Murdoch does not care how much money he loses on the Fox News channel. He doesn't care. He simply wants to go on transforming the political landscape until, frankly, this is a full-blown fascist state in which fascism is, as was described, wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. Robert Perry refers to liberals as media orphans. He says, while gratified to be given a few hours each night on MSNBC, the left, surely had nothing to compare with Murdoch's News Corporation and its long-standing commitment to right-wing perspective on Fox News and News Corp's many other print and electronic outlets. He said, as I wrote in an article last November, Olbermann and the other liberal hosts are essentially on borrowed time, much the way Phil Donahue was before getting axed in the run-up to George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, when MSNBC wanted to position itself as a patriotic war booster. He says that the ongoing significance of America's media imbalance is that it gives the right enormous capabilities to control the national debate, not only during election campaigns, but year-round. Republicans can deploy what intelligence operatives call agitpropaganda, stirring controversies that rile up the public and redound to the GOP's advantage. These techniques have proved so effective that not even gifted political speakers, whether the savvy Bill Clinton or the eloquent Barack Obama, have had any consistent success in countering the angry cacophony that the right can orchestrate. Man, he does write some pretty words, doesn't he? And not only are they pretty, they are terrifyingly true. I've said it before, so it probably bears saying again, that what? That, and I say this because I've seen some back and forth speculation on, you know, maybe Keith's going to go out there and form his own online internet, blah, 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 blah. But the fact of the matter is, he doesn't have enough money to do what needs doing. There is only a very small handful of people on the planet that have the money to do what needs doing. One of those is, really, no kidding, George Soros. Because George is far more wealthy than Rupert Murdoch, and George is also far more liquid. George Soros could pump out the money that it would take to form a 24/7 cable news channel similar to, and yet at the same time utterly dissimilar from, Fox News, and never even move a decimal point in his accounts. It badly needs doing. Because whatever it was that drove Keith Olbermann away from MSNBC is not going to be any easier for Rachel Maddow to deal with, for Lawrence O'Donnell to deal with, or if they should happen to give him his own show, Cenk Uygur or Sam Cedar. Bless their hearts, MSNBC does appear to have a fascination with Air America alumni. And more power to them. But that again exposes yet another problem that our side has, and that is that we don't evince. You know what? Air America is gone. There's nobody else out there developing talent. Oh, wait a minute. There's the Horn. We've developed a bunch of talent over the years. Going all the way back to the beginnings, Joe Vecchio could get in behind a microphone in any city in America. And do radio day in and day out and do a damn good job of it. He proved it. Peter Godbold is as good a spokesperson as the LGBT and liaison, even to the straight community, as the LGBT community has ever had. Bruce Birch had magnificent pipes and great good humor. John Fox started out as a guy who really didn't want to do anything that hadn't been post-production, and fast realized that he was equally well-suited to the live hot mic. Guy James? Please. I would rather listen to Guy James than almost any other liberal talker out there. And now, the guy who follows me at 9 p.m., Rick Smith. Rick is the best newish liberal talk talent to come into the terrestrial broadcast spectrum in I don't know how long. He is that good, that consistently that good. The Horn has done a lot of good work. And we have exposed a lot of great talent. No, that's not true, Betsy. That is not true at all. She says, we didn't develop Guy James, though. He kind of developed us. No, Guy James had his own show coming in. But Guy had never done 5 days a week before he started with us on the Horn. Just as the Horn has been here as Rick Smith has transitioned into being 5 days a week. But the problem lies in the fact that apparently at MSNBC, to get a shot, you have to, at some point or another, be able to say that you put in time at that massive failed Operation Air America, which is kind of a pity, because we can't afford to simply hope that another talent will come along. Rush Limbaugh will eventually breathe out and not breathe in again. And that will be a great blessing when it happens. But the right wing is deeply invested in making sure that there's somebody there to take his place. Glenn Beck is about 20 years younger than him. And there are people 20 years younger than Beck that are being developed. Our side cannot say that. Our side is a loose amalgam of people who think that they have what it takes to do it. and who then try the business of getting behind a microphone for five nights a week to see what it's really like, with very little support and even less money. This is not the Horn funding pitch. This is not the Horn funding request. These are the facts of life as a liberal media person. And there are people out there who do not get around microphones, but whom we know, given the opportunity and a check, would absolutely light up the airwaves, would be pure broadcast magic. But again, our side worries about things like this year's donut budget and whether or not we should use pre-printed packaged sunflower seeds for our outreach or the old-school emery boards. That's why we are where we are. But it was a real kick in the teeth to see Keith Olbermann disappear. And apparently there are some sorts of non-compete clauses. He can't come back on TV for like 6 to 9 months. The New York Times story reported that today. What's interesting out of that is that they said, well, Keith, you can't go on TV for 6 to 9 months, but, well, you're free to do radio or that internet thingy. And there's where the fun lies. Because the big boss daddies of the for-profit media still haven't figured out that the future of broadcasting is on the interweb tubes. And not necessarily over their cables and their centralized networks and their broadcast studios in Weehawken. And so if, in fact, Keith Olbermann does move over into the internet, he may very well take several million people with him. And I am more than happy, for as long as the for-profit media big boss daddies don't figure it out, I'm more than happy for them to think that the internet is just some little digital backwater, some little electronic ghetto that doesn't really matter. Because you and I, we know otherwise, don't we? Yeah. They do not have, the right wing has not yet figured out how to take total control of the internet. And as long as this, the longer they don't figure it out, the better we are. Well, notwithstanding things like Rupert Murdoch's pending deal with Apple to sell Rupert Murdoch's content on the iPad. It just gives me the shivers. And by the way, for those of you who follow such things, I think Olbermann said his first tweet will be tonight at, he said, precisely 8 p.m. Kenneth writes in and he says, Bob, there's Pacifica. What about Pacifica? What about Pacifica? God knows I can't hear them around here, and they can't be heard very many other places either, outside of fairly large metropolitan areas. See, that's the trick. That's the trick. Rush Limbaugh is not huge across, doesn't have the numbers he has because of his listeners in New York or Philly or Miami. Rush Limbaugh is big because Rush Limbaugh recognized the value of putting 3 hours of right-wing hate and drivel on a little AM station in Busted Knuckle. Or, you know, Ass Cheek, Arkansas. That is where the value comes. People who live in cities are they're mostly very busy people. It's a little bit different in small town flyover America. And how many Pacifica people are on MSNBC? Yeah, I didn't think so. No, the so-called liberal broadcast paradigm right now is that if you aren't on Air America, you're nowhere, man. So we've got that this evening. Oh, we've got a ton this evening. Just an absolute ton. I don't know. Would Slappy Thomas, if we still had a majority in the House, would Slappy Thomas's nondisclosure be enough to crank up some impeachment hearings? Probably not. Because while he says he opposes affirmative action, by God, that would go away in a hurry if the House impeached him. Then it would be for one reason and one reason only. Because they will wave, the beauty of a right-wing hypocrite is that a right-wing hypocrite will wave the bloody shirt the minute that it seems productive and profitable to do so. You know what I mean? Thought you did. So it is Moran Monday, and you probably have your own nominations to offer. And I welcome them. So, you know the number, right? 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Yeah, I don't feel exactly right back into the saddle, but I have a this is certainly, at least for me, better than sitting propped up in the bed somewhere, starving. At least here I get to talk, and I'm talking, my mind is taken off of one of those things that I love in the world, food. And I'm a big, I love soup. But soup gets real tiresome real quick. I don't care if I never see Progresso's savory chicken noodle again. No. Tiresome. Just tiresome. But you, like I said, you know the phone numbers. You know the email address, bobkincaid@gmail.com. bobkincaid@gmail.com. We will take a little break, and we will come back to your phone calls as you see fit. New callers are always welcome. We have never lost one yet, so you are welcome just give it a try. You'll find out you make it through very nicely. That's one of the beautiful things about this being conversation radio. There's time to establish that conversational presence. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
I heard you on the wireless back in 52, lying awake intently tuning in on you. If I was young, it didn't stop you coming through.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Hey guys, I know I don't say this enough, but I'm going to say it now. When push comes to shove, you guys are always there for me. You really hung in there. And, you've always been so close to me. So, don't take this the wrong way, but I got you something. I love you guys.
Aw, we love you too.
I love you guys. Powder for your nads. By Bubble Genius.
BubbleGenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Before I go back to the phones, or go to the phones, you can't go back to somewhere you haven't been yet. Probably involves physics that I don't understand. Let me expand just a little bit on the developed talent kind of thing. See, everybody there's not a everybody isn't can't be a multimillionaire, widely disseminated national whatever. Talent doesn't always go national. What the right wing has, if you were to start driving from the East Coast and drive across the middle of America to the West Coast and listen during morning drive time and afternoon drive time and the noon hour in some places, what you would find is that the right wing has assiduously, by virtue of owning most of the radio audiences licenses in this country, the right wing has been able to develop a huge cadre of so-called talent. Now, most of these people could be driven insane by putting them in a round room and telling them to pee in the corner, but they're there, and some are better at it than others. Remember, Glenn Beck is where he is because he started out as a failed morning zoo crew jock. Hey, it's 7 o'clock! Wake up, you slackers! It's the zoo crew! You know, kazoo sounds, stuff like that. Big wreck out on the big wreck out on the connectors. Stay away from that. Take local routes if you can. Hey, let's go to the weather. Oh, look, it's weather. Ugh. And that's also where Limbaugh started out. Well, not many liberals own very many. Not many liberals own radio stations. So that means, by definition, that there's not going to be a lot of talent developed on the liberal side of the microphone in the place where talent was traditionally developed. You know, pimply-faced 15-year-olds who get a job spinning records from 9 to midnight. Records. Oh, dear, I dated myself. But they're all across America. Almost every market, from teeny tiny microscopic all the way to major markets, has a right winger that is known in his or her community. It cannot be said for our side. So it doesn't matter how many talents an Air America or a Pacifica develop. It doesn't matter. Because you still have to have a greater quantum of talent from which to choose. Because you want those people who are happy in their communities doing what they're doing. You really want them there. And while they may struggle or try, or maybe not try, to climb up the ladder, succeed or fail, you've got something going on in individual communities. You should hear the sewer, the absolute pouring sewer that flows into the airwaves over Beckley, West Virginia between 9 a.m. and noon every day. No, you shouldn't hear it. You can just trust me that it does. And this is a clown upon whom talent has never sullied itself. He has never been visited by the first muse. I mean, if he has, he's been visited by Brachiadia, the muse of walking on one's knuckles. But he's there every day. And the same is true across the United States. If you would answer the question of how liberals and progressives begin to draw broadcast parity, it begins with owning radio stations. Then somebody has to actually start, and TV stations. And then somebody has to show some interest in developing talent. And so once you've got the people and the talent developers and the radio stations, then you've got places to get the message out to. I'm solely on the internet because I gave up on terrestrial radio a long time ago. And not because I couldn't resist saying fun words. I'm well versed in how not to do that. But because there comes a point where doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result becomes the definition of insanity. So I'm happy where I am. And Lord knows I love you guys to pieces. If I had the opportunity to go into terrestrial broadcast again, would I? I don't know. I don't know. The offer hasn't been made. But I do know that where you and I are now, we are living in the future, while the terrestrial media back there are still trying to find out why they can't order buggy whips anymore. If you know what I mean. It's a complicated problem, and one that, oddly enough, could best be solved by vast quantities of money. Funny how that works. But enough of me. Let's talk about you. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Hey, Susan.
Well, I've got my candidate.
For Moran Monday?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, goody.
Let's see. There is, besides Gerald Duffy. I have a tie between Governor Rick Perry and all of the Republican politicians who are not going to CPAC this year.
Yeah, because the homos are going to be there. They're going to be there's going to be a homo sponsor at CPAC, and we'll probably all have to get all gayness.
Rick Perry makes the list because after all of that time he spent bashing Obama and the stimulus. Guess which state is using the most stimulus money to vote?
Oh, Texas, of course.
Of course. Now, to deal with the Glenn Beck thing, did you listen? Did you just hear it, or did you see the film?
Which?
The shoot him in the head thing.
Yeah, I saw the video and heard the audio. Yes.
Well, what I spotted immediately was the swastika in the background.
Oh yeah, but then again, that's like walking into a funeral home and seeing flowers.
Well, and I'm sitting there, he's going on and on and on with all this eliminationist rhetoric, and here's this big as life and twice as ugly, bloody swastika in the background, and I'm going, oh my God. And, geez, somebody needs to lock this dude up in one of those spiffy suits. Now, but lots of it behind his back. Anyway, here's the deal with the Overman thing. Politico, is the guy named Ben Johnson that writes for Politico.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a column that, according to him, Governor Ed Rendell is all set to sign as a MSNBC contributor, and guess who is big buddies with Comcast?
Ed Rendell?
Yeah.
I saw the Ed Rendell mention. I didn't read the story, so they're saying that... I've talked from time to time, Susan, about how when you work in the commercial world, sooner or later you engage in self-censorship, whether you mean to or not. If, for instance, you're sponsored by something seemingly benign like Colgate toothpaste, and they're a good sponsor and they've been really good to you over the years, and then a story breaks about how Colgate is made in China and it's got poison in it that's killing little children. Well, Colgate's been good to you over the years, so aren't you going to be a little less than willing? Well, I think the same thing can be said maybe of, and this is speculation, maybe of Olbermann. Knowing that Comcast was coming in would make you really, really uncomfortable, because sooner or later you knew that you were going to run up against your mm-hmm. ethics were going to run up against the commercial desire to stay in their good graces. You see what I'm saying?
Okay, here's another piece of information I ran across. It wasn't just Olbermann that went out the door.
Who else?
His entire crew went with him.
Well, then he must have been able to pay. Were they fired, or?
That's the question.
And it's a question he will be, it'll be tough to, well, hopefully we'll get some answers to the extent that we feel like we're entitled to them.
If they were canned, boy, have they got grounds for a lawsuit. I mean, geez, Louise. You know, firing the crew because the star got canned? Oh, man.
But he didn't get canned.
Or, shall we say, agreed to leave?
Yeah, see, they would have had to pay a liquidated damages had they canned him, because he was under contract.
Well, let me put it this way. They made it so uncomfortable that it was a case of...
Well, that's not what I've read. I've read that if this feels like gossip, I don't mean to pour it to, but I've read that he's wanted out since, like, April. And that he brought in a new management team from a new management company, mm-hmm. you know, agents, specifically to negotiate him out of the next 2 years of his contract.
Yeah.
And that while he might not have wanted to go this precipitously, and it was clear that it was precipitous, from the fact that he tweeted a Thurber reading of one story and then changed Thurber readings to a shorter story, I presume in order to have enough time to get to say the goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, these are just little details. He wanted out, but he didn't know when they were going to say, you know, okay, fine, you win, get out.
Yeah. And the fact that the staff had to go with him, letting him go because of these contract negotiations, you know, they agreed to part company. If in the process they dumped the staff, AKA fired, that's bad.
Is this verified?
No. Now, here's the deal. If they went with him voluntarily, that's another matter entirely.
Yeah.
They were going on about it, they were talking about it on Stephanie Miller. about the fact that it was a crew that was, you know, tuned like a Swiss watch. And the fact that the whole crew went.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. But, you know, my big problem is, well, first of all, you don't have Countdown anymore. And like you said, one of the things that the right-wingers are doing in these markets, what they're doing is, like, they'll put Rush on one radio station, and then they'll counter-program with Rush.
Yeah, it's called saturation. It's called market saturation, yes.
Yeah, you can't get rid of him. And sometimes you're offered a choice. You get that. And, you know, I'm going, oh, my God. I'm just praying these idiots don't really find out what the Internet is until we can get, you know, established. But I'm kind of losing hope. I did exercise my right of protest in the only way I knew how, in the only way that matters.
Just don't watch it.
With the on-off button.
Well, but the problem is we kind of still do like having Rachel there, right?
Rachel ain't on yet.
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Because I saw a lot of flurries of, I'll never watch MSNBC again. And that's a great way to make sure that we have no liberal voices on TV. You know, I can't imagine ever deliberately tuning in to Ed Schultz. But I guess he meets a need for some people.
Ed Schultz has been moved to 10. They've got Cenk Uygur in Kiesel's spot.
No, Cenk isn't. No, Lawrence O'Donnell's in the 8 o'clock slot.
Yeah, okay. Well, then just temporarily. Oh, wait a minute. No. They got Cenk in Ed's old spot. Pardon me. I'm sorry.
And Ed at 10 following Rachel.
Right.
Which is kind of a kiss of death, really.
I figure I'll tune in for Rachel, and then, bye. I don't need the rest of it.
Right.
And their sponsors can go. Their sponsors can go to hell. You know, if they want to play games like this, well, they don't get me watching their commercials. Sorry about that, guys.
But to the extent that we value Rachel, I think it is important that
Rachel.
Yeah.
But the rest of it, forget it. I wasn't interested to begin with. I always turned them off.
Well, frankly, Olbermann or Rachel, either one, I tend to watch in internet clips as opposed to sitting and watching the whole program. Yeah, Olbermann, because he was on during the time that I'm working, and Rachel, because it makes for really interesting things happening inside my brain. But at 9 p.m., I always have two radio shows going at the same time. Rick Smith and Malloy.
Oh, my.
And, you know, once you get used to it, you can kind of make sense of it. It's like listening for the drums on one side and the guitar on the other in a stereo piece. You can get used to it.
Yeah, kinda.
It works. Well, Susan, have yourself a good night, and hopefully I'll be back here tomorrow night too.
Well,
we'll see if this just sucks all the energy out of me, or if I've got enough to get at it after tomorrow.
Take care of yourself and get my best day.
I sure will. You take care. Bye now.
Say bye-bye.
News Ninja Susan calling from Oregon. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
No food. Chowder? Can you have chowder?
No chowder.
Oh, my God.
Clear broth-based soup.
I couldn't do it. I would so cheat all the time.
Well, no, not if cheating means getting sicker.
Well, you know, the way I would do it.
It's kind of like a drunk taking antabuse.
Right. Well, the way I would do is I would do kind of like a, well, this is the food portion of the, maybe a little bit sickening. I wouldn't eat it, if you know what I mean. I would just taste it. And just
swirl it around your mouth and spit it out like a bourbon taster. Right, sure you would.
Yeah. No, I would. I've done that before. Just to get the taste of something. You know, if that's all you have, that's all you have.
Oh, I've been snorting the inside of a bag of Reese's Pieces for a week now.
Oh, that'll work. I have two before I begin, I just want to recommend something to the listeners and yourself as well, Bob. You have to. When I say you have to, there is no, I might check it out. You have to. You have to listen to the latest Marc Maron podcast today. He interviews Henry Rollins. It's awesome.
Oh, that would be good.
You got it. Everyone, you have to listen to it. It's amazing. What he covers in an hour, Maron is a master. A master. And what he did with Henry Rollins, I'm telling you, he's going to have so many fans. So many fans. His podcast right now is just blowing up all over the place. I mean, he interviewed Kevin Smith last week. Now he's on Henry Rollins. Who's he going to do next week? You know, Bill Cosby? Who knows? Who knows? But, yeah, so I suggest to people to check it out. It's an amazing. I mean, it covers his life. He has some great political anecdotes in his life that he talks about. And it's just, I mean, if I could rate it, it's 4 or 5 star. Easy. So there you go. No more teasing people, just you have to check it out. I've done my plug for the night, that's it.
Wow.
So there you go, yeah. So moving on to my Moran nominations. The first one is Rahm Emanuel. Wow.
That was a little bit, I got to admit, there was a chuckle involved when I saw that news.
I know, but you know how simple it would have been just to claim your residence a year earlier? It was such a simple little thing. I mean, I understand it's probably a Republican right-wing trick, but I mean, Rahm Emanuel
worked for Cheney.
I know. I mean, Rahm Emanuel thought he was above the rules. See, Rahm, when you're in a red state world, doesn't work like that. They'll get you under the slightest technicality. And that's what they were waiting for. They probably knew that. They were probably waiting for him. They knew he was going to run for mayor, and they had backroom meetings. It's like, you know, this idiot, he didn't claim his residence for Chicago. Oh, man. We can't wait till he comes back here. I mean, because that's what they're like. They have a plan for the master plan, people. That's what it's like. And people scoff at me and say, nah, that's not. No, they do. When the master plan is broken, they have a plan for that plan. The master plan behind the master plan, and that's what liberals need to start talking about. Like, okay, so you have a plan, but do you have a plan if that one doesn't work? Because that's what the Republicans do every day.
It's the truth. They don't. Well, it's filed under the general corollary of what Boss Man Wayne said a long time ago. Republicans don't take the day off.
Yeah. And the second one is a surprise, but not a moron in the sense that I think he's a moron or I don't like him, but Obama in this op-ed on Reagan saw that we are all patriots. Have you seen this shit?
No.
Let me read the first paragraph, because you can't take any more, Bob. I don't even think you take the whole op-ed. This is really ridiculous, like Sandra would be saying. But I mean, this is not satire, people. This is Obama, an op-ed on Reagan today. President Reagan recognized the American people's hunger for accountability and change, putting our nation on a bold new path toward both. And although he knew the conflicts between parties and political adversaries were inevitable, he also knew that they would never be strong enough to break the ties that bind us together. He understood that while we may see the world differently and hold different opinions about what's best for our country, the fact remains that we are all patriots who put the welfare of our fellow citizens above all else. What bullshit, Bob. And let me say.
Yeah, glad you stopped there.
Wait, but let me say something else. This is propelling that myth of Reagan even further. even further. And you should see some of the comments on this. You know it's USA Today. You think people just rallied around Obama and said, that's our president. That's our president giving giving proper respect to the hero of my generation. No, that's not what they said. They said Obama, fraud Obama, just constantly
right. Downless. Well, isn't that just evidence that he kind of still don't get it?
It's evidence of that, and it's probably evidence that USA Today rigs their comment sections as well. I mean, it's a
well, there is that.
It's a twofer in that stuff. But I mean, to me, here's the thing about it. This is the problem, because people have elevated Reagan so much, and the left didn't learn from this. The left was afraid of being critical to Reagan when they were at the when they were at the dinner when they were at the social dinners and like that, and they would just nod their head. And now we have to deal with this gigantic myth that isn't true. This guy was not agreeable. He was not agreeable to both sides.
No.
He was completely petulant. And the fact is, you will check anytime you go on the TV, you can't say this now. It's forbidden. It's you can't say anything. You can't give anything a criticism. But can you do that for Jimmy Carter?
No, well, I'm not. I mean, you can't say anything good about Jimmy Carter.
That's right. You can't say anything good about Jimmy Carter. So you see, I don't see why the Democrats still don't get it. But stop talking about conservative heroes, because the conservatives hate you anyways, and start talking about liberal and left-wing heroes that don't get mentioned enough. I mean, that's my piece on this whole Obama op-ed, and it's, I mean, I understand why he did it, but at the same time, it's like, this is something that the left suffers from so greatly, Bob.
Oh, to say the very least.
I mean, there's so many people that you could mention right now that do not get mentioned, that need to be mentioned and promoted. And I don't know, it's definitely something that I mean, if I could, I would just put a wish and say no more mentioning of Reagan being a hero on the left side. I mean, because it's been done enough, people. I mean, come on. And the other thing is you didn't really know Reagan to begin with, so to try to personally...
Well, bless her heart, Rachel did a brilliant job with that this past Friday. I don't know if you saw the clip of her standing up to that creepy sort of Steve Forbes look-alike wannabe Stephen Moore from the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're talking about the Bill Maher thing, yeah.
Yeah, when she... Because he engaged in... It's always the same with these slimy right-wingers. The minute that somebody starts to make a point, it doesn't matter if they're repeating the prologue to the Canterbury Tales or talking about their butt itching. They will do it at 20 more decibels than whoever is talking, just to make sure that the point doesn't get out. But unfortunately, Rachel actually stood up from the table and continued to talk, and wouldn't let the creep overtalk her, and she finally got out the fact that if you were among the richest of the rich, living in Reagan world was a grand and glorious time, but if you were the rest of us, it sucked.
Yeah, that was a good moment on the Bill Maher show, and also a good moment was when they interviewed Russell Simmons, and they asked him about Reagan. He said, Reagan wasn't a hero to me. And I thought that was well-deserved, because that needs to be said more and more. You need to have that dissonance. You can't just have this agreeance just because you think that it's politically acceptable in this climate. This is the only way out, to just say, yeah, I agree, Reagan was a great president. No, you should really say what's on your mind. And I appreciate for what Rachel did. So on that note... about the whole issue about the idolizing Reagan. Yeah, I think it's high time that someone like Rachel Maddow decided to do that on a national program. Even though it was on HBO, it's still, you know, it's still something, as they say.
Exactly. You know, so we have that. It's right. One of those.
And you know, the other thing I wanted to mention But before I leave, is the Keith Olbermann thing. Now I'm going to take a whole different tactic and say the following. Keith Olbermann, if you read his history, he's always been a person that has been very volatile throughout his career, and he's very hard to deal with, as a lot of people have said in the past, even if you're on his side. I was reading something, I don't know if you read this article, I was reading something how the Lawrence O'Donnell feud started, and if that's true, that even tells me more about Olbermann than I need to know. But O'Donnell put on his Twitter feed, he said something like about liberals and Social Security and Obama, and he didn't even mention Olbermann's name, and I guess O'Donnell asked him to be on the program when he was going to be on the air for, I guess, his debut show, and Olbermann said, or I don't know if it was his debut show, not his debut show, but he wanted to be on the program, and Olbermann responded to him, he goes, "I saw what you Twittered." And to me, I mean, he didn't even mention Olbermann's name. So there is this emotional behavior that Olbermann displays, and he puts it out there. And if you cross him, or if he senses that you cross him just a little bit, he does put in that emotional outburst. And I think what people need to realize is rather than looking at the person, the personality, you have to look at the person and how he deals with other people. And I think there's a reason why he just gets up and just leaves and goes someplace else. And here's the other thing, Bob. He never blames it on himself. Never has any blame for himself. It's always somebody else. It's still Griffin. It's this guy. It's that guy. And to me, that's not healthy. I know someone like that, and I asked him. I said, "Why is it you can't blame yourself for anything?" I was like, "You always trying to find someone, an excuse for somebody." And he would always say to me, "Well, you know, if it wasn't for this person," I said, you need to let it go and just realize maybe you messed up here." But he couldn't do it. And I think Olbermann, he's one of those personalities. And it'll be interesting to see where he goes. But I think people should keep in mind the fact that Olbermann shares a lot to blame for what went on MSNBC, it's most likely.
That makes yes.
And that's not, here's the thing about that. I'm not being critical of someone, but I noticed.
No. There are different, I know people like that. I would hazard a guess that everybody listening knows someone like that.
Right.
And, you know, then there are the polar opposites. When something's going sideways in my world.
Right.
I generally look for what I did wrong.
Exactly.
And not what somebody else did, because, and I think it's philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
Or attitudinal, or some other interesting word.
Okay.
Because from my standpoint, if there's a problem and I go looking and I find something I did wrong, that means that I have the power to correct that. I have the power to fix it. Whereas if you're prone to going and looking at what somebody else did wrong, all that means is that you get to gripe about it.
Mm.
And in our world, there is a whole lot of griping going on. I mean, people who know me very well will tell you that they frequently have to say, "Bob, this one's not on you, buddy."
Right.
Sometimes my wife says, "Bob, honey, it's not always about you."
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because in the article they talk about Olbermann and the fact that he would have these stressful emotional breakdowns when he was shooting the show. Sometimes he would have these emotional outbursts, and he even admitted to him himself. But I think the thing is that with someone like Olbermann is the fact that we need to continue to realize that we can't put someone like that on a pedestal and just worship the personality as the person. And I think that's a common mistake that we see on the left. And we always, and I notice people are going after Comcast immediately, which I can understand that, but at the same time, I mean, let's face it, Olbermann has
well, that was easy to do, because
yeah,
we know how slippery, sleazy, and otherwise slimy the Comcast deal is, because we understand what it means for net neutrality, point of view in broadcast media, all of that. So naturally, when there's someone coming into the room with a butcher knife in their hands, oh dear, there's the meta. No, when there's somebody coming into the room who is munching on a bulb of garlic, and suddenly everybody smells garlic, it's natural to look at the guy who's eating it. Does this make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So, you know, naturally that's it, Comcast, it was easy to look toward Comcast. But on the other hand, David, and I think this is rather important, if your job is to sit there like newsreaders of old and just hold the copy, this is pre-teleprompter, mind you, and just hold the copy in front of you and try to get all the words right, and that really is the acme of your job performance, is saying the words right, then if you got all the words right, you put it down at the end of the evening, and you walk away and you say, congratulations to me for a job well done. Right?
Yeah.
But if you are principled, if you are driven to do the absolute best that you can, then you're going to be very, very hard on yourself. You know, I'm sure you've heard me on this program a number of times talk about the nights when I just felt like the show sucked, and my image for it is that at the end of the show I curled up in a fetal ball in the corner and sucked my thumb.
Yeah.
That. Because if you care about the performance quality, if you care about the presentation quality, if it's more than just getting the words in the right order and saying them right, then you are going to be hard on yourself. You know, one of the people who is notoriously hard on himself, to the point that there are stories about it, is Letterman. Letterman will, or unless he's had some sort of like therapy because of his bypass and his heart and everything, Letterman was notorious for just beating the piss out of himself over what he thought was a bad show. You know, we've got, and contrast that against the egomania of Bill O'Reilly, and it, we'll do it live! You know, that's just him being a prick. And then, if you will pardon the intrusion, then there's this, one of my favorite outtakes in all history.
We're up to our long distance dedication, and this one is about kids and pets and a situation that we can all understand, whether we have kids or pets or neither. It's from a man in Cincinnati, Ohio, and here's what he writes. Dear Casey, this may seem to be a strange dedication request, but I'm quite sincere, and it'll mean a lot if you play it. Recently, there was a death in our family. He was a little dog named Snuckles, but he was most certainly a part of... Let's come start again. From coming out of the record. Play the record, okay? Please. See, when you come out of those up-tempo goddamn numbers, man, it's impossible to make those transitions, and then you got to go into somebody dying. You know, they do this to me all the time. I don't know what the hell they do it for, but goddamn it, if we can't come out of a slow record, I don't understand it. Is Don on the phone? Okay, I want a goddamn concerted effort to come out of a record that isn't a fucking up-tempo record every time I do a goddamn death dedication. Now, make it, and I also want to know what happened to the pictures I was supposed to see this week. This is a last goddamn time. I want somebody to use his fucking brain to not come out of a goddamn record that is that's up-tempo, and I got to talk about a fucking dog dying.
I love it.
Yeah.
Because I'm not excusing the conduct. There's another great clip out there of, oh, God, who was the great jazz drummer? I can't remember. No, see, that was on the brain cell I killed. But where he takes it, they're in
Buddy
a break.
Rich?
Yeah, Buddy Rich.
Okay.
And he takes his whole band into the bus during a break and just unloads on them, you know. You're gonna sit there and blah 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 on me, and I'm carrying you, and I'm feeding you, and I'm feeding your, you know, and it's just one long F-bomb.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has a bad day.
Oh yeah.
But some of this also comes from a desire to do it and do it right. You know, I always wanted to know what the song was, the up-tempo song that they were coming out of where he had to announce the dead dog, because I just had this vision of lover boys. Everybody's working for the weekend. And then, you know, long-distance dedication about a dead dog. You know, that'd piss me off, too. But, I mean, I wasn't just dropping that in there gratuitously, because people who live in a performance-oriented world live in a world that is slightly different, and a publicly perceived performance at that.
Right.
Live in a slightly different... oh, my God, Yago in the chat room telling me it was, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Oh, Jesus.
Or it was Atomic Dog.
Well, you know, that's the thing. It wasn't me and you and a dog named Blue, which would have worked.
Yeah.
Or Patches. Oh, Jesus. But the whole thing is, people get a reputation for being hard to work with, when in fact, what they are is hyper dedicated to their craft.
Hmm.
You know, the old story, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, about Led Zeppelin, not Led Zeppelin, Van Halen's contract insisting on all the brown M&Ms being removed.
Mm-hmm.
It was later explained to me that that was not egomania. That was to see if the local event provider, the local venue, was paying attention to the contract. Because right. In a rock and roll show of that size, people can get badly hurt if everything is not done just so. Ask John Fox.
Mm.
And so if they got the M&Ms right, chances are they got the electricity right. Whereas if they, M&Ms, screw it, then they get to walk, because it's probably not a safe working environment. And because at the end of the day, we seem to forget that performance-based work is exactly that. It's work. You know,
right.
all of the people who sit down and watch Inside Edition or all of those crappy little programs with celebrity gossip all over them, and you know, we see Snooki and Paris Hilton and yada 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 yada, celebrity world. We tend to forget that those people are working. I always say, David, for instance, that anybody who ever hopes to eat in a restaurant should spend at least one night waiting tables and washing dishes.
Mm.
Because you get a bigger sense for what goes into it. And by the same token, anybody who wants to talk about the indolent life of a movie star should probably have the opportunity to at least view the work on the set sometimes, because it's mind-numbing. The time in between setups of shots and the attention to detail, and especially more so for screen actors than for, like, stage actors, you have to be able to turn it on and off like a water faucet.
Right.
And you are at the director's whim, not your own. And so that will occasionally lead to performers pouting in their trailers. And they're not pouting because they're spoiled babies. They're pouting because it is brain-grinding work.
I agree with you. My take is that I think that Oberman found the perfect out when the Comcast and the NBC merger went through, and he knew it was time to go. I don't think Comcast fired him. They would have just put him under tighter reins. I was thinking about it. At first, I thought that's what happened. But then I started thinking about... I started thinking about Oberman's attitude toward MSNBC recently, and I said, you know, this is the perfect out for him. This is the perfect strategy. Hopefully he has something lined up next to him. I would say, like you, I would say go to the Internet, and hopefully he could find an audience and build back an audience that would be willing to listen to him in some format that he would put together. I don't know, maybe do what Kevin Pollak did. Hopefully he would understand that maybe he won't get the same kind of... viewership and the same kind of salary that he got before. But to me, I think that is always that's always overemphasized. And I think a lot of these personalities need to realize that the most important thing is the message and the presence that's there, and that you're inspiring someone and you're motivating someone to do something at that moment. And I think that's one of the reasons why Kevin Pollak is on Ustream and he takes the show and he's built it to what I would consider a success. I mean, people listen to it. People listen to it every week. That he has the reruns going. He has guests every week.
Well, and I guess the question is, and in a commercial world, you have to ask this question sooner or later, yeah. David, is it making any money? Because Kevin Pollak, being the extremely talented character actor that he is, among other things, one would presume can live off something besides the Ustream show.
Yeah, I would think that it's being his revenues are coming from somewhere else. Yeah, coming from someplace lights, movies, stars, action, that kind of thing. Yeah, I think though that Olbermann, if he does go to the internet, he can get advertising. But I mean, it's going to be advertising that is a bit quirky, like him. I mean, that to me, that's how you build brands on the internet, Bob. And a lot of people they don't understand.
Well, if he goes to the internet and figures out a way to build a sustainable, viable money making model, he will have done people a tremendous service, because he will have a name that is big enough that when he goes to some corporate ad buying agencies, because again, your salespeople don't go to individual companies, they go to ad buying agencies who then decide whether or not to place their clients' ads with your network/program. If he's able to do that, it will be a sea change in internet broadcasting, and it will be the next step forward, because nobody else has figured out a way to make it pay for itself. I don't know what the rates are. Now, if you want to watch, for instance, if you wanted to watch a clip of Olbermann, you had to sit every clip. You had to sit through this interminable TV ad, and it was annoying as hell. And you know, Ustream has adopted that model, where, like for instance, if the Horn does something live on Ustream, when you connect to Ustream, you have to watch a 1 minute ad, and then it will just connect to the stream. Wherever, however, and the only way that Ustream has figured out to make you not have to do that is for you to pay Ustream directly, and we ain't got that kind of walking around money. But look, I've gotten to the point where it just annoys the life out of me to try to watch a YouTube video, because of all the damned Google ads that are constantly popping up at the bottom of the view screen.
I understand what you're saying. You know, when you were talking about the sponsorships and making it a profitable model, I think the person one of the radio talk shows that's been semi-successful at this, because they've actually picked up radio stations. I don't know if you know this, but the libertarian radio show Radio Free Talk, based in New Hampshire, Bob, they're moving like crazy. I mean, they have sponsors. I think they picked up 40 radio stations so far, and they did it reverse. Like, they started on the internet. And they're able to keep the content and the freedom of the show, of what they want to talk about and what they want to discuss, and the radio stations still pick them up, which I think is pretty interesting.
Well, that is, but also they're working the right wing side of the street, so that means getting advertisers is manifestly simpler, because even if you're a libertarian, you are still going to be hustling a pro corporate agenda, which means that you're operating for profit, and that profit is the defining quality of what you're doing. We can't do that here.
Well, Bob, I don't know about that. Then it's not really that kind of pro corporate kind of. They pick up sponsors that are. I wouldn't consider on that side. What I'm saying is, it's a bit of mix. It's a bit of mixture of that. And like I said, when they allow people to talk about what they want, and they have widespread views. And again, I think a model like that, maybe for I don't know how that would work on the Olbermann on the internet, but I'll tell you this: Olbermann's going to need like as many moderators as North Korea has in their military, his chat room, because there's no way that he's not going to get a backlash once he solidifies himself. As soon as he announces, I am going to make an internet presence now, if that's what he's planning to do, which we don't know. I mean, but this might be the kind of same thing would happen with the tech TV the Tech TV host who now hosts Tech show on Sunday. So it's going to be interesting to watch, though.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. Well, David, great conversation tonight. I really appreciate it. You got a comment in from Michael, otherwise known as Kid A, from the chat room.
Right.
On the stuff you started with, namely Ronnie Raygun. Michael says, "Oh Christ, I want to stab my ears with an ice pick. How long will it be before Democratic Party candidates need to be asked, who is your favorite politician other than Reagan? With that qualifier being just as necessary as it is when you ask a group of Repiglicans." Says Michael, "Obama, no. Obama, no. Jesus Christ, man." Head, and then he writes, "Head smash desk."
Well, you know, in closing, even Ronnie Reagan Jr. doesn't want to talk about his father, so there you go.
Well, he doesn't want to talk about him except to write a book on his 100th birthday.
Right. Right.
I happened to be, well, it was when I went to the hospital to get some tests done. You know, you have to sit around and read a 19-year-old magazine, and they happened to have the recent Sunday's Parade magazine there, so I flipped it open to read an excerpt of Ronald Reagan Jr.'s book about his dad.
Right.
And apparently, and you know, it was pretty vanilla.
Yeah.
But apparently, I guess there's a war going on. Well, a profound dispute going on. See how hard it is to take that crap out of your language once you start trying? There's a profound dispute going on between Michael Reagan and Ronald Reagan Jr. Because Michael Reagan has tried to lay claim to ownership of Ronald Reagan's corpse, practically, to flog it around to promote himself. Now, this is the same guy, Michael Reagan, who urged his listeners to shoot people.
Right, right.
Yeah, great guy. Just ask him. He'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I've never been a member of Cult Reagan, and odds are I never will be a member of Cult Reagan.
It's amazing how they built that myth up so fast, though.
I know what Reagan's presidency was like. I remember what it was like.
Right, right.
I was alive for it. I watched my father's career go down the drain during it.
Mm.
And as a consequence, yeah, that had an effect on me, but it also had an effect on my peers and I as well, because within the first couple of years of his presidency, when the only place in the United States with a higher unemployment rate than where I was born and raised was Detroit, Michigan. I mean, unemployment was it was a total disaster, and you know Alabama earned it because it turned its back on its Democratic Party roots, and that was the beginning of the Reagan Democrats, and they voted for what was done to them. But you know what? They're voting Republican still. They still haven't figured it out.
Well, you know, you may want to play that clip for some people who haven't seen that Bill Maher episode of what Rachel Maddow said about Reagan, if you can find it.
Well, it really does. It doesn't translate, though, because you can't see her when she finally literally stands up to that right-wing punk-ass teabag and thug.
Mm.
But I think the clip is available over at Crooks and Liars for those who want to go looking for it. David, good talking to you, brother.
All right, later, Bob.
Take care. Bye now. 13 minutes before the hour, and we move onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Oh, my God. And he also said in this op-ed, he understood that it's always morning in America. That was his gift. And we remain forever grateful. No, MF-er.
No.
Yeah. Listen, I don't know what's going on with Obama. He had lost his goddamn mind. Let me tell you. When I was 3, my mother told me that Lyndon Johnson had to intervene to keep that motherfucker from closing daycare centers in California. Okay? Unless, you know, Reagan's a horror show. That was when I was 3, and then I got bigger, and I was all of a sudden this bitch is president. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was a nightmare. He was governor in California when I was little. And there he was, and then all of a sudden, when I was voting, this bitch was running for president. It's a nightmare. I hate Ronald Reagan. He was a horrible president, and ushered in some really lethal shit. And how dare Obama? I don't know what the hell he thinks.
Well, I've always said that the people better be ready with bail money if I'm ever near Reagan's grave in a belly with a belly full of beer, because I'm going to piss on it.
No, no, he was terrible. And this whole love affair that Obama's having with Reagan, it's just nauseating. It's like, dude. But I see his shit got shut down about Social Security. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, yeah. But by the same token, his approval numbers are the highest they've been since November 2009?
Oh, yeah.
And this is supposed to be, we're supposed to understand that that's the payoff for talking about Reagan real nice-like. I saw that Morning in America reference, Sandra, and it just about made me want to vomit scream.
No, we're supposed to bow down because his numbers are up. No, I'm pretty much done with Obama. I'm sort of like, yeah, right. He's straight up because Americans don't really know about neoliberalism. But this fool is the neoliberal president. I mean, everything points to it. He's not interested in a direct jobs program. He thinks that tax cuts are going to spur what? Demand? We know demand is the issue. But all he's talking about is competitiveness? That's code for fucking up unions. I'm sorry to be cussing.
Oh, no, that's okay, because it is. Please. That is code.
Give me a break. And so I'm just sort of like, dude. But I thought it was kind of interesting about the Social Security, because I know that was on the table. Don't say it wasn't.
I wouldn't do it.
Them poll numbers came at him like, I don't know what. They're like, you know, those, I think that's...
Well, have you heard, Jesus. I guess I haven't been off the pills long enough. Have you heard the latest poll number? And this is the one that just makes you, you know, face down into the cream of wheat. They polled teabaggers. Now teabaggers are an independently polled group, by the way, which is not good news. But teabaggers got polled. It's absolutely fascinating. Public policy polling asked teabaggers, and this is the question. Currently, workers pay Social Security payroll taxes on up to $106,800 of their salary. To ensure the long-term viability of Social Security, would you rather have people pay Social Security taxes on salaries above $106,800, or would you rather see benefits cut and the retirement age increased to age 69? This question was asked to a representative sample of teabaggers, Sandra. Care to guess the answer?
Oh, well, I would say that they said you can raise that ceiling right now.
Yeah, teabaggers, 67, not just any tea, 67% of teabaggers, Sandra, said raise the payroll cap. Only 20% cut benefits.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, Obama and his people, they're in a fantasy world about those particular entitlements. And, you know, I was sort of scratching my head thinking, is he really going to do this? But then them pollsters are interesting because they didn't have to ask that question. That's another thing I find quite interesting. So it seems to still be the third rail at the end of the day. And I just think it's very interesting.
Well, I'd like to see a little more amperage put on the rail, frankly.
No. I agree. I still think that it's up for grabs. Because, I mean, if he is, with his evil triangulation, I still think they'll be coming back for it. But it's, I don't know. I just thought that he had to pull up a bit. And I'm starting to refer to him as the enemy now. You know, I'm really sad. I feel bad saying it. And, you know, it's just between me and you and whoever else listens to
right.
this lovely show. But I'm fish-eyeing this fool. He, there's never any, not even a peep about the decimation of minority communities right now. And I'm like, dude.
Well, he's not allowed to talk about anything that directly affects specifically minority communities. Because, you know, then the teabaggers will get mad again and start talking about how he's got a deep-seated hatred of white people.
Right, but and like you brought up right then, the fact that they pulled the precious tea parties and even they don't want you messing with Social Security, we're supposed to assume that, oh, that's why you're not bringing it up. You see, and that's what really makes me sick, Bob.
But Sandra, even with this polling data, as salutary as it might seem, there is still a great big giant ginormous honking lie that underpins it. You know, like the question I read, to ensure the long-term viability of Social Security, blah, blah, blah. Well, Jesus, is 2078 not long-term enough?
No, it's incredible. I mean, they've done an amazing job trying to confuse the issue, but at the end of the day, like we said before, it's intergenerational, and no matter what group you point to, they can jump and find someone who needs these programs, you see? I don't know. I guess they have to keep beating, you know, driving more of the middle class into poverty because they're not quite.
But I mean, I know that I had an email exchange with Benedict from the chat room the other day, and I know there are people out there, James Galbraith for one, who know that the answer to any perceived problem with Social Security is, has nothing to do with raising the age or cutting benefits. It has everything in the world to do with lowering the retirement age
and bringing more income into the program.
Right. And where are the people on the so-called not Fox networks talking about this? Why is it you? Why is it me? Why is it Tom Hartman? Why?
Because they don't care. I mean, I don't mean to be, you know.
They got theirs, screw us.
Right, I realize that's not very articulate, but at the end of the day, I think that's what a lot of it comes down to, because those bastards who are talking and making policies, I'm not too sure where it affects them, except for them getting votes and Obama being the one to just finish off the Democratic Party. I mean, apparently, he got a lot of pushback from people in the party. You know?
Well, maybe that's part of that make me do it strategy.
I don't really know, but I'm glad that at least, whatever, I don't have to sit here tomorrow and listen to that garbage. I don't know what garbage we're going to listen to. Probably compare.
Well, you've heard what George Will says that is going to happen.
What?
Every special interest political group in the country gets its political erogenous zone stroked. He said that on Sunday TV.
Ew. Are you kidding?
No. It put me right off of my frosted flakes.
I missed that. I'm glad I did.
It's interesting when George W. Bush was throwing out hand jobs in the State of the Union, George Will was as quiet as the tomb.
Oh yeah, well yeah, you know they can't give away anything to the Negro except for that freak. Krautheimer is like Obama's new best friend, isn't he? Get it at.
I did kind of notice that. That's good.
And it's like, ew.
When that's your buddy?
Yeah, well, the thing about him is I never really paid attention to him until he was criticizing Christopher Reeves, you know, fellow wheelchair-bound people, saying, how dare he give people hope, is what he basically said. This was years ago, and I'm like, who the hell is this? He was upset. You know, because it's like, I guess, I don't know if he's paraplegic, I don't know what his situation is, but he was really upset with Christopher Reeve because of his advocacy for it. And I thought, ew. And so I started following this guy, and then I see he's some sort of neocon freak, but I just thought that was really warped.
Oh, yeah. The first time I ever saw Charles Krauthammer's name on a piece, it was in the late 80s, early 90s, and I took the New Republic at school. And there was Charles Krauthammer in the New Republic. I remember it well. And I remember the first time I saw his name, I went, oh, Krauthammer. I didn't know they put parody pieces in. I didn't know this was like... I thought it was a joke.
Oh, right, because of the name. Yeah, so you're not right.
And then I read it and went, oh. 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 And then I kind of folded it. Wait a minute. Because I had thought the New Republic was something that, you know, liberals could read.
Mm.
But it was icky.
He's terrible.
Oh, and by the way, Michael, who wrote in a few minutes ago about the Jesus Christ Barack no Reagan moment, poor Michael's going to wind up with a concussion from the head smash desk that's going on in his world right now. He said, by the way, we could get God off of our money in this country. It'd be easy. The fundies would be cool with it. Real cool. Problem is, we'd have to replace In God We Trust with In Reagan We Trust.
Oh.
If such a bill were proposed by Obama, his poll numbers would shoot through the roof.
It's too... I mean, all of it is too much. I mean, I suppose it's just like that Emmett, whatever his name is, the GE guy that he appointed.
Yeah, Jeffrey Immelt.
Immelt. I mean, obviously it just must be about campaign contributions, because anyone who's familiar with GE, all they do is outsource. And so to associate him with job creation is like a joke. You know what I'm saying? I just laughed. I thought, really? You know, so it must just be about campaign contributions, because is this man supposed to create jobs here or over in India? I'm confused.
Well, so too am I.
Because that'll make no sense, except for just the final financialization of his administration, and we can just call it a day, I guess.
I wish I had a viable crystal ball, Sandra. You have no idea how many times a day I sit there thinking, you know, God, I wish this was 11-dimensional chess. I really, really do. But with stuff like Immelt and the Reagan op-ed,
it's just nonstop. It's just coming.
I mean, as a real live, honest to Jesus liberal, the most that I could say about the Reagan op-ed was that it was an exercise in very, very thin, onion skin thin political cynicism, because I didn't fall for it, and I don't think the wingnuts are going to fall for it either. I don't think they're going to think that Barack Obama really loves Reagan and wants to be Reagan. They're gonna attack him for hypocrisy, among other things.
Well, it's incredible, because it's the same as these people who think that Reagan had a huge hand in bringing down the Soviet Union. That's like some sort of running joke, too, you know?
And there they were on Bill Maher's show, and David Stockman is sitting there. David effing Stockman. And
I'm sorry, I effed up the economy guy?
Yeah.
Oh.
And they're sitting there talking about Reagan, and in particular, that walking piece of human excrement, Stephen Moore, is talking about Reagan as if he were some sort of expert on Reagan. And Stockman is sitting two chairs down from him, looking at him like he's got six heads. Until Maher finally said, "Excuse me, we just happened to have in the room Ronald Reagan's former budget director." And made Moore shut the hell up, and Stockman just sat there and laid it out. Laid out how unfair it was. Laid out how predatory it was. Because, you know, I guess they... And the sense I get from Stockman is that everybody in the room knew what they were doing, with the possible exception of Ronald Reagan, who was referred to in the chat room as an Alzheimer's-stricken old cat's paw.
Well, even his son alluded to that recently. You know what I mean? I don't mean the wannabe, that horrible Michael Reagan, but the...
Ronnie Jr.
Reagan. Yeah, and it's just kind of like, but I'm done. Yeah, my eyes have still not recovered from the the week-long state funeral. Remember that?
Ugh.
God damn, that was just hideous. You know, I mean, don't. Please, I don't even want to start. Reagan was god-awful. He was terrible. And, you know, I curse it that what's-his-face didn't shoot him up more. I don't care. You know, we could have been spared all that.
You know, there are about four different lines I could use in response to that. I'm not touching any of them.
Well, you don't have to. You know, I probably shouldn't have said it, but, you know, if I hadn't have met the motherfucker when I was a child, he scared me. So I got, you know, I'm scared.
Yeah, right. I you know, dude kicks off his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Excuse me?
Yeah, no, just terrible. I mean, I'll never forgive my babysitter for dragging me to that little meet and greet your governor, you know?
Ooh. God, what I wouldn't give if there was a photograph.
Oh, I know. Well, anyway, yeah, Reagan. You know, it's like I grew up in Sacramento, so Reagan was all over the show. Trust me.
Well, no, I mean, okay, I'll go ahead and say it. Why couldn't Brinkley have shot Lennon and Chapman shot Reagan?
Right. I don't, yeah. I mean, let's be, you know, listen.
I mean, that story, the excerpt that I read of the Reagan book recounts the story of the surgeon who, because he talks about how his daddy was quipping jokes going into surgery. He'd
right.
tried a one-liner in the emergency room, and then he tried it out again going into surgery, and he looked at the surgeon and said, "Well, I certainly hope you're all Republicans." And the surgeon looks at him and says, "Mr. President, today we're all Republicans." You think anybody'd say that to a shot Democrat?
No, it is. It's too much. And it's just, you know, because we're the same age. So we were in full effect with the Reagan years.
Oh, yeah.
And so was Obama. And it's just like, dude, you know, what in the world?
I came home from college desperately needing a job so I could go back to my next year of college. And I will never forget that one summer, because I wound up, I would have had no job had it not been for the CETA program.
CETA? Shit.
Remember CETA?
Yeah, please.
I laid, over the course of that summer, I laid two soccer fields worth of sod.
Wow.
I turned the baseball diamonds where I'd played baseball as a little boy into soccer fields. And I'll never forget it because I was the only white guy on the crew. And the other guys were trying to teach me a little bit because, you know, I'm being the duty bound, honor bound, hard little white boy worker. And the guys that I'm working with every morning look at me going, "Shit, lay off. You ain't getting paid enough to work this hard. Making the rest of us look bad." And you know what? After about 2 weeks, it got all the way through to my brain. I went, "Wait a minute." Because we had these surly little racist taskmasters.
Mm.
And they were, oh my God, they were nasty people. And they were just hateful. And treated everybody like crap. And I feel that was one of those Bob figures out white privilege in a hurry moments. And I figured it out real quick because I lost it. I lost it. The overseers for that CETA program, make work, you know, lay the sod stuff, they were living in a colorblind world. And they hated every one of us. So there you go. And I learned real quick on the CETA program what time of day it was. But it was minimum wage. It was $3.35 an hour. I got third degree burns from being in the hot Alabama sun.
We both came of age during the Reagan years, and you were doing that, and my ass left the country. I got the hell out.
I got a feeling you got the better end of the stick.
Because I missed a good chunk of the Reagan presidency. I have to go. But yeah, anyway, I don't know. I just am kind of. Oh my God, they're trying to track me down, Bob.
No, I'm loving it. I'm loving the ringtone.
Oh God, listen. I know this is, you know, a bit of a spastic call. I just was sort of a.
Member of the Democratic Party president writes glowing op-eds about Ronald Reagan, it's okay to not be okay with that.
Well, and it's just sort of when you talk about Reagan and you know, it's not from any sort of no analytical perspective. It's because I was just right there and I'm like, you know?
Yeah, and again, I'm not some sort of purist who, you know, wants that whole Pharaoh, you know, let the name of Reagan no longer be spoken in the land of Egypt. I don't ask for that. The man existed. He has his little place in history, whatever it may be. But to laud that morning in America, BS, Sandra?
I know, that's what I'm saying.
Help me, Jesus.
That was why that one line just sort of killed me. It was just like, no.
I mean, because I remember what the Morning in America ad was about. It was about convincing the world what a soft little pinko commie his opponent was. And I can't, that was the 84 campaign, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it was just sort of, I don't know, yeah, I'm sort of just in a state of shock that Obama is persisting in this narrative, and it's just like, okay, you know, I guess he'll get reelected, and then God knows what his second be like.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway. Well,
Sandra, you need to take that one. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. Sandra calling from California. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, what's going on?
Hey, what's up, Reverbo?
David got me going on our friend Ronnie. I mean, one of the most amazing PR creations ever. I mean, the modern Republican doesn't even attempt to masquerade as America's sunrise, do they?
No. The modern Republican Party is all about, well, you know, there's been an episode of South Park running recently in which Kyle gets hooked up with Cthulhu. You know, the Dark Lord of the Universe.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, that's what the Republicans and teabaggers are. They're running around with Cthulhu and proud of it.
Yeah, there's not even an effort to conceal their evil ways. But here, are you familiar with the guy named William, I guess you pronounce it, Kleinecht? And the book is called The Man Who Sold the World.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan. Yeah, well, just listen to this just from the intro. I mean, I don't know how they managed to do this. Just real quick, Reagan, when the layers of myth are peeled away, was arguably the least patriotic president in American history. He laid the foundation for a new global economic order in which nationhood would gradually become meaningless. He enacted policies that helped wipe out the high-paying jobs for the working class that was a real backbone of the country. And Jesus Christ, this guy totally betrayed the people who voted him in.
But he did it while wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross.
Oh, God. And the Democrats still don't understand how to do this. Although, they hate that they have to do it that way. I don't know how you do it. Like you say, it's just an ownership thing. You have to buy radio and TV things. The guy goes on. This supposed guardian of traditional values was the architect of wrenching social change that swept across the country in the 80s. The emergence of an eerie, over-commercialized, postmodern America that has left so much of the populace psychically adrift. Reagan propelled the transition to hypercapitalism, an epoch in which the forces of self-interest and profit seek to make a final rout of traditional human values.
Score!
Bingo, his legacy. Here, let's have them. Mergers, deregulation, tax cuts for the wealthy, privatization, globalization. Da 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 da. Help weaken the family and arrest.
Yeah, anybody, does anybody remember PATCO? Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization?
Oh, a once proud union, those guys?
Yeah. And how Ronald Reagan sort of left the flying public to sort of get home by their own devices with whatever broke-ass bastard was sitting behind the scope? Yeah, I do. You know, the other thing, you mentioned, you know, families and so forth. There's a statistic out there that I saw a long time ago that just really, really had an impact on me, Reverbo, and it was this. And this, I don't mean this as a commentary on the quality of families in the modern age. It's just a fact. The last time that American families were statistically dominated by a two-spouse household in which one spouse worked and the other spouse stayed home and took care of the youngins, you know, that Leave It to Beaver world that the teabaggers and the right-wingers so desperately want to return to, Reverbo?
When was that?
That was the Carter administration. It began dying the instant that Ronald Reagan took office because suddenly both spouses had to work their asses off not to get ahead, but to merely stay afloat, to keep even or a little bit behind.
Yeah. And let me guess, what happened to their kids?
Well, that also coincides with the shifts in educational policy, in which suddenly it was no longer fashionable to teach things like civics.
Mm-hmm. And of course we suffered then, and then not to mention the huge attachment, an emotional problem. Just the generations are suffering from now because of it. I mean, you get strangers raising your family, raising your kids.
Right, but that was job creation because we created created more jobs in the child care sector. Kind of grim, isn't it?
Brilliant. It's brilliant. The guy won by a landslide. Well, of course, he rigged it quite nicely. What was his name? Was that the CIA director? What was the one I'm thinking of here? He was going to testify, he had a stroke that affected his vocal cords.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one. What is that, Robert?
From the Iran. Yeah, he was going to drop the, basically what it rolls down to is he was going to drop the dime on Ronnie.
I mean, Carter didn't help himself much with all that inflation and whatnot, but.
Well, no, stop. The inflation was there when Carter took office. The inflation was there when Ford took office. Carter gets the blame for it, but as I've mentioned in the past, there are these little things that happen when you're young, Reverbo.
Okay.
And for some reason or another, they lodge in your memory. And this is one of those. Because I remember when Gerald Ford made a speech, and he came out to the podium at the White House or wherever the hell he was, and he had a red button on his lapel. It was a red button with white letters across it, all caps, WIN. And Gerald Ford was going to solve the runaway inflation that was eating our country alive.
Remember that.
By having every American wear that red button with the white letters WIN across it, which stood for WHIP.
I got it.
Inflation now.
I remember that.
As if working families in America somehow had the power to revitalize the strength of the American dollar. Which of course we didn't, but it very cleverly shifted the burden and the blame for inflation away from Gerald Ford and onto God knows how the American working people, what were left of them.
Imagine that.
But Carter, you're right, takes the rap for inflation because it was still on the upswing of that hateful curve.
Yeah, yeah. Payback for the Vietnam War start. Well, that must have had some sort of bad effect on our economy. I mean, they didn't.
Do you not remember? Do you not? I mean, you're a little bit older than I am. Not castigating you or anything, but do you not remember when Ronald Reagan, when Richard Nixon, see one crook, another crook, they all run together. When Richard Nixon put price controls in place. Can you imagine what would happen if a Republican tried to do that today? The teabaggers would show up with tanks claiming that they wanted prices to spiral out of control. I'm not kidding.
I know. Well, they still seem to be looking at us as the take the blame and save the country at the same time. Somehow it is my fault, and they're trying to, you know, they desperately need their dollars, and they're just going to do so. Of course, they're just going to squeeze dimes out of the working people. You know, they're not going to make the Pentagon take the hit.
You'll pardon my cynicism if I think that that's the way it's supposed to work. You know, again, I go back to that much used line back in, back during the financial meltdown, that in America, loss or profit is capitalized and loss is socialized.
There you go.
because you know what? People lost their homes. That wasn't socialized. But Wall Street—they didn't even lose. It's like when some fundamentalist says, "Have you found Jesus?" And the first thing out of our mouth should always be, "You've lost him again." No, he ain't lost. We know where he is. And Wall Street didn't lose that money. It just went places that Wall Street objected to it going. Because it's all just electronic transfers. This is all just Vonnegut stuff, right, Reverbo?
Oh, it is. And it happens in 7 or 8 seconds they're making these trades. That's what I've been reading.
Yeah, and they're trading on the 16th decimal point or something like that.
Yeah, it's insanity. But yet they still look to me, they're going to go ahead and they're going to cut, you know, public funding for autism, and they're going to cut, you know, mental health centers, money for those, and they're going to close libraries, you know, another day, and they're going to, they think they're going to somehow rebuild the economy doing that. But, you know, heaven forbid they're going to make the wealthy take a hit, or make the Pentagon take a hit. It's just repulsive. It's just the same thing all
over. Oh, by the way, my email just went absolutely berserk with an entire raft of people saying, Casey, William Casey, for God's sake, CIA brain tumor. Can you say Bob Casey? Bill Casey. But William Casey.
Thank you, everyone. Yes, yeah, William Casey.
Yeah, I mean, there's nearly a dozen of those.
Yeah, you're just about ready to just, you know, drop, spill the beans, and damn, the last thing you said was, "Boy, I'm sure glad I've never had a stroke."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, I got corrected by Ron in Raleigh. He says you left out Nixon. You left out part of the equation. Under Nixon, there were wage and price controls, the single most socialistic legislation in American history. Price controls are gone, but wage controls remain. How about that?
How about that? Hey, real quick, I wanted to touch on something that it sort of dovetails with all of this. So I'm listening to NPR, which I just continue to do because it's the only thing on the main networks that I can listen to. And they occasionally actually give me weather. By the way, it's been just freezing in Baltimore. I just thought I'd let you know.
When that wind whips in over across off Chesapeake Bay, brutal. 40 degrees feels like zero.
Well, 22 degrees feels, that's what I'm talking about. It's 18 degrees. But anyways, I'm listening to NPR, and this is maybe a week or two ago. You know, it's one of their, you know, I don't know, top of the hour, bottom of the hour, little five-minute headline blurbs, you know. And somebody gets on there and the blurb, the headline is something like middle class caught not saving enough money, or you know, baby boomers feeling the pinch, didn't quite prepare for all this. And I started to think about this whole new normal thing again, and how, you know, Bob, the spin on it is going to be that somehow you and I caused all of it.
It's our fault.
We caused it, our own problem. I mean, and then of course,
somewhere along the way, somebody out there walked under a ladder, stepped on a crack, broke a mirror, and the economy is so godforsaken fragile that that's what did it. Wall Street had not a damn thing to do with it.
Even more, society has nothing to do with it. Right?
Personal responsibility, Reverbo.
I don't know how they get this, how they add these things up, but they do. We have only ourselves to blame.
But isn't there, to be fair, isn't there an element of truth in that?
Look,
I don't mean where you're suggesting that it's coming from. I mean, and you know what? You know all those bumper stickers that you saw during the Bush era? Don't blame me, I voted for Kerry. Don't blame me, I voted for Gore.
Mm-hmm.
Those things began to proliferate like mushrooms after a spring rain after a while. because people felt a really deep-seated need to let the rest of the world know that they were not personally responsible for the utterly avoidable murder of a million civilians in Iraq, that they were not responsible for running up the national debt on a credit card that the right wing and the Republican Party still will not acknowledge. So yeah, we, as in we the people, we are responsible. Because on the one hand, in the year 2000, shortly after the November elections, we the people did not demand that they count every vote in Florida. And Al Gore has some culpability in that too. But more importantly, in 2004, and 2004 really is important, Reverbo, because the rest of the world sort of forgave us the vote count in Florida fiasco. Because it was clear to everybody in the world that that election had been bald-faced stolen. But in 2004, when the rest of the world woke up and saw our election results and saw we had re-elected, more or less.
Don't do this. Don't.
That little troll.
That little fuck.
When the rest of the world, they went, oh, wait a minute. You people are crazy, aren't you? You're just nuts. If you're not nuts, you're stupid.
No, we're passionate about stupid over here.
Yeah, we take our stupid seriously.
Yeah.
And so they're right for the wrong reasons, the right wing is. Because they, in this personal responsibility thing and the coming it's all our fault excuse. Well, it is, it's our fault. It's some significant portion of the American electorate's fault because, you know, and this is one of the few places where any conversations are had along these lines. Things like consumer choices in the marketplace have a moral and ethical component to them. And I would say 99% of the population of this country does not acknowledge that, let alone think about it. And two, what goes on in the voting booth has a really, really moral and really, really ethical component to it. And the problem is, our side actually thinks about that. You know, our side is madder for more concretely discernible and discoverable and describable reasons with Barack Obama than the birthers and the deathers and the tenthers and the booger eaters could ever hope to be.
Well, that's our integrity is also our constant downfall. We talked about this many times. Our side only is successful if we do think. If you don't think, I mean, it really just is that simple. Thinking or not thinking, that's all you need to know.
Yeah. On the other hand, the right wing goes into the voting booth and says, which one's going to protect the snowflake babies?
Yeah.
I'm voting for him.
And those
are the people who need a good talking to. You know, those are the people who elicit the Jed Clampett line about, well, these days I got a long talk with that boy.
Well, according to the research that we've all read, those people aren't even smart enough to know how stupid they are. You can't talk to them. Look, right,
because that. And the attempt to have the long talk with that boy is a fool's errand, Reverbo.
Well, it is. That's why this idea of being a uniter almost is a foolish concept. I don't want to unite anybody. I just want to get a bigger army than you and annihilate you.
I mean, in the wake of Tucson, there's stuff out there. There's one creep. Oh God, which one is it? Let me scroll down to him because it's really sickening, and I just need somebody to suffer with this as much as I have. Yeah, I'm getting some relief, as Jerry Clower would say. I'll be there in a minute. It just takes me a second.
If I go into the car dealership and I'm taking a look, you know, I'm kind of looking at a Chevy, and In about 3 hours, I walk out of there with a Cadillac Escalade and a 7-year balloon payment. Whose fault is that? Who's to blame for that?
Right. There's a great scene in the George C. Scott film, The Flim Flam Man.
Yeah, I remember that movie.
Where he's on the run again, and he's crossing a river on a ferry or something. You know, one of the ones that's made of wood and drawn by rope.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I do not consider myself a criminal. I consider myself to be, and you know, the George C. Scott voice, I consider myself to be performing a public service. I am educating people. And there's an element of truth in that. When people, it almost seems like it's not a crime when people are running around saying crazy things and voting and using their franchise for insane purposes, where when they sign on for the free lunch and it turns out there's no such thing as a free lunch, when you know it's part of one of Fields' three commandments, Reverbo. The first commandment is you can't cheat an honest man. And I've maintained that that is as profound a statement as any human being has ever uttered in the somewhat long history of human consciousness. You can't cheat an honest man because the essence of a cheat, the essence of all cons, lies in preying upon the essential dishonesty of the person you're conning. Because you make the person being conned think they're getting it over on you. And the minute you've got them in that place, you can fleece them. And to a certain extent, the Republican Party is desperately trying to teach that lesson to its own adherents, but they refuse to learn. No, what I said a minute ago about the crazy stuff that just burbles along on the surface of our political body politic, Senator Mike Lee, who is the new guy from Utah. He's a teabagger. He was interviewed by Christiane Amanpour, which must have just really driven him crazy. Probably thinks she's a terrorist. He was asked about so-called dialing down the rhetoric in this country.
Okay.
You're not ready for this. I don't care how ready you think you are, River.
I don't know if I should stand up or sit down.
I'd sit.
Okay.
Because then at least when you stand, the screaming is better. In this interview with Christiane Amanpour, he announced that dialing down violent political rhetoric, you know, the eliminationist stuff that we've talked about on this program so many times, about stopping referring to politics as wars and battles and targets and shooting and taking out and killing a political career and all the things that the right wing is so very, very committed to and so very good at. He says, if we dial down the political, I'm paraphrasing, if we dial down the political rhetoric, the shooter wins.
What?
Yeah.
If we dial down the rhetoric.
Well, wait, you know, don't take my word for it. I got it right here.
I'm not.
But just days later, on a sunny Saturday morning, their energy and enthusiasm was stolen by a gunman in Tucson. Their colleague, Democratic Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords of Arizona, was shot in the head. 13 people were wounded. 6 were dead. And while no one wanted to believe politics motivated the shooter, the ramifications rippled throughout government.
I think it was very appropriate for us to pause for that week and to really take measure of the event.
How has that affected the atmosphere here?
It did change things, the tone a little bit here.
Will it increase any civility between the different parties?
Yeah, you know, I think the one thing that's been missing the last couple of years is there's been really no true debate. It's been, you know, one side kind of pushes through whatever they want.
Everyone involved in the process would rather see a more civil discourse, one that focuses on the issues and the policies at play, the things that affect the American people.
One small example of that new tone, The job-killing health care bill...
Job-killing, job-killing, their job-killing government takeover of health care.
...is now at least referred to differently.
Destroy jobs in America.
But Congressman Schilling isn't backing down.
You know, it's still a job-killing bill. It's a job crusher. You know, you call it what you will.
And neither is Senator Lee.
The shooter wins if we who have been elected change what we do just because of what he did.
Got that? So they're not going to stop talking about killing things, Reverbo.
No, they're not. Otherwise, the shooter. Well, right. Just somehow are they? I seem to remember how we were not going to let Osama bin Laden. We weren't going to change the way we behaved based on. This is an old song. I know that we've heard this thing this all before. People, dude, this is such horseshit.
Yes, it is.
I have heard all of this before. Yeah, and then the fine print, of course, is that, you know, well, it's all in a fine print. I will leave you with this. This is something amusing that a friend of mine sent me. He cut out part of a box, looks like a DVD box or a, you know, it was a DVD of a movie. And he didn't, the title of this movie is not visible. All I did was cut out the movie rating and the definition of how this became a PG-13. You'll like this. Remember, we do not know what the movie is. Okay, it rated a PG-13. And I quote, intense epic battle sequences and warfare, sensuality, language, and some smoking.
Holy cow.
What could that be? That's going to be Home Alone 9? I mean, what could this be?
Father wore tights? I don't know.
So we've got battle sequences and warfare. Then we have, of course, sensuality. And then it just has comma, language, and some smoking.
I got to know.
That will give you a PG-13.
Some smoking.
And some language.
Language.
Intense epic battle scene. Of course, you know, just some kids.
Battlefield and, Earth?
I don't know. Some kids in the Noggin is going to get you an R for sure, but intense battle scenes and smoking, all that, you know, that's
PG-13. Across the, all, yeah, absolutely. And of course, I love that. I always love lines like "some language, Reverbo." The other night, I was asked by a nurse, "Do you think you have a temperature?" I answered her, "I'm pretty sure I have a temperature. My question is whether I have a temperature above 98.6, which we call in my country a fever." I can be a cranky patient. Some language. Some language. Well, God, it's a talkie. I'd hope there'd be a lot of language.
One can only imagine what this movie is. Or how they even come. I mean, I just love how you get, how you qualify for one that we're just rating.
It's beautiful.
I don't know. It sounds like a movie we should all see.
You know, the epic battle sequences?
Well, who's doing all the, who's doing some smoking? God. Oh, Jesus. Hey, can we keep calling him Boner as long as he keeps calling it the job-killing Obamacare repeal? They have the sense of humor.
Oh, I'm going to keep calling him Boner no matter what. Until I find someone who will give me a proper German pronunciation of it, I'm going with Boner. Because I'm pretty sure the proper German pronunciation is not Boehner.
Well, I think they're pretty much demanding that we call him that. They've got the comedic sensibilities of frat boys at an FAC. These guys.
Oh, I was absolutely laid low the other day by this remark the new speaker gave when someone asked him. Well, it was either where are the jobs going to come from, or I think it was, what programs are you going to cut? And John Boehner responded by saying, who you asking? You asking me?
Oh, yeah, I think I saw
you. You can't buy that.
He didn't quite have an answer for that.
Yeah, because somehow I can't work him up to a good Robert De Niro in terms, you know, you talking to me?
Mm-mm. You know, another thing, they keep propagating the difference between facts and rationality and faith and belief, because, you know, he doesn't, quote, believe the CBO numbers about health insurance. They just decided they don't believe them.
Right, faith-based.
Yeah. So it's good to see that they're still pushing that. I just don't believe that the sun, you know, rises in the east. I just don't believe it.
And you know what? As long as you don't believe it, you know, again, it's the Tinkerbell theory of governance. If you don't believe it, it's not real.
Well, then he's the boner, and he's going to be, you know, he's insisting on it.
Yeah, there it is. Boner on what spending cuts the House GOP plans to enact. You're asking me? I guess he's going to do some laissez-faire speakering. God Almighty.
We'll just see. Tomorrow night is. So this Olbermann thing. You know, the only thing I can think of is that, you know, the only reason that Murdoch tolerates the Simpsons, obviously, is because they're just so highly rated. So you're talking. People have been throwing around numbers of, you know, a couple of million people that Olbermann's going to take with him, well, maybe over to the internet.
Yeah, right.
Well, I guess that wasn't enough to. Well, of course, the Simpsons, of course, but remember, they're not real.
Yeah.
They have no. Maybe Olbermann's just got so much integrity he could just bust.
Well, his much awaited 8 p.m. tweet that was coming out consisted of the following: citizens of the free world, greetings. That was Olbermann's 8 p.m. tweet.
Man's gone bye-bye.
Well, you know, I think he knows his marketing.
You're right about people, but, you know, they're always labeled difficult when, that's just the label people give folks who are usually smarter than them.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to, there's a line from Bull Durham, where Kevin Costner's character gives Tim Robbins' character, you know, the young rookie pitcher, a little lecture about just how to live life. He picks up his flip-flops in the shower and he says, your shower shoes are filthy. He said, when you get up to the show and you're making millions of dollars and you have filthy shower shoes, they'll say you're eccentric. Down here, you're just a slob. Clean your shower shoes.
Sweet. Couldn't have said it better.
Reverbo, have a great evening. I'm so glad to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. And don't forget.
Make it personal.
Make it personal. All right.
All right. Try to stay warm. Later.
All right.
Bye now. Reverbo, calling from the Balmer area. And, you know, you can't start out a phone call referencing a song like this without it getting played somewhere along the way. It was suggested by two people, both Ron and Raleigh and Michael, Kid A. So, yeah, a couple of bars of this, I think, are more than called for. Then we'll get the rest of the calls in.
We passed up on the stairs. Spoke up wasn't when, although I wasn't there. He said I was his friend, which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone a long, long time ago. I know.
Thin White Deer. David Bowie. The man who sold the world. You know what? That lyric is oddly reminiscent of Ronald Reagan. It really does fit, doesn't it? So let's see who's still on the line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Jim.
How are you?
Getting better, I hope.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. You know, you started out this program tonight referencing Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Mm-hmm.
One of the characters in that film was none other than Ben Stein. Is that his name?
Yes.
Who is a regular contributor to one of my favorite programs, CBS Sunday Morning.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about Barack Obama. And he said the Republicans don't need to find a candidate. They've got him. And all he needs to do is to change parties.
Brutal. And...
Well, I mean, you know, personally, I think Ben Stein is one of the biggest bleeding assholes of the world.
He is that. Flim-flam man, con artist, the works.
Yeah. And, you know, it made perfect sense to me. So that's exactly what Obama could do. He could just change parties and get reelected handily.
God, can you imagine what would happen in this country?
Nothing.
No. No, I don't think it would fall. It would be a mathematical zero, Jim. I think there would be a lot of conniptions in a lot of corners. Because
maybe we ought to exhume Ronald Reagan and put him in a glass case like they have Chairman Mao in Beijing. You know, maybe they ought to do that.
I'm honestly surprised we didn't.
I've heard so much about that asshole tonight that I almost hung up. Tell you the truth.
But it's not like anybody just decided to make this a Ronald Reagan show.
That stupid son of a bitch. My God. How many times have I referenced on this program David Stockman's book, The Power of Politics?
Yes.
When he exposed that asshole for what he fucking was. Remember?
And now the right wing does, instead of confronting what a gigantic fraud and monster Reagan was, instead of doing that, they did what Republicans always do. They attacked the messenger, and David Stockman became persona non grata.
Oh, yeah, because the first thing came out right after he became Reagan's OMB director, he put an article in the Atlantic Monthly about supply-side economics and Laffer and all that crap. And, of course, Stockman got hauled in there by Reagan's chief of staff. I mean, how many did he have?
Oh,
I don't know.
No, I don't either, but yeah.
Nonetheless, I mean, you know, he got his ass hauled in over the calls, but Stockman was at least honest enough to say, look, you're pursuing an invalid economic policy that's going to have terrible ramifications in generations to come and set precedents, and yet these people go back and they have to worship at the temple of Ronald Reagan, who was a shitty governor in California, as Sandra pointed out, and was a complete zero with all of his great communicator crap.
See, I never fell for that. Did he ever strike you as being a great communicator, Jim?
Bob, I work for the son of a bitch as my commander-in-chief. I spent many years working for the federal government under the Reagan administration, okay? And I saw that stuff. And I saw stuff coming down, do more with less, do this, that, and the other. I saw social programs being cut. And I saw the fucking insensitivity of that man toward people who didn't make $100,000 a year. And he said, if you don't do that, you're broke. And I saw the shit that his wife used to put out on the on this, that, and the other, trying to exonerate her husband and protect Ronnie. And I heard all that crap. And it just made me absolutely ill. And, you know, it's just for him to be dragged out by Obama. Oh, Lord, it makes me absolutely livid. And I don't need to be upset by that stuff, but I, you know, just what is Obama thinking? I mean, who is keeping the brain in his house tonight?
Well, this is
Michelle.
This is all the calculus that goes into re-election. That's what he's thinking about, re-election. That's all he's thinking about.
I think he's thinking about re-election as well as his former chief of staff is. Boy, he sure got his ass handed to him, didn't he?
Yeah, that was ugly. Or not ugly, but I'm quite sure it was most unexpected.
And well-deserved.
I couldn't agree more. You know, how hard would it have been, like was said early in the program, for him just to, you know, it's not like he's hurting for cash. Rent a crummy little apartment in Chicago and have done.
Yeah, he had put together more money than any of the other 22 candidates, right?
Yeah.
And now he can't run. And
But Jim, bear in mind, it's only an appeals court decision, and the election is third week of February, and this thing will yet have to go to the Illinois Supreme Court.
Yeah, but the suspense is 31 January.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, it'll be heard by the Supreme Court in a matter of days.
Well, I mean, is this a question of degrees of pregnancy? Either he's capable of being a candidate or not. I mean,
it's not quite that simple, Jim, because what you have, as you well know, any appeal is always going to be based upon the record established in courts below. This thing started with the election commission and then a lower body in the out of the city government. Then it went to this appellate court. And what will have to be determined is whether or not the appellate court got it right in overturning the decisions of the two lower tribunals that said, yes, he can run. And that's a little bit of a higher standard. They're going to have to find that the appellate court abused its discretion or some other standard similar to that. And my money says that's what they'll find.
Which is?
That he can properly run. And that the appellate court abused its discretion. Because questions of domicile are not questions of actual residency, but rather of intent to live there at some unstated indeterminate period in the future.
Well, wouldn't the court have realized that when they ruled against him?
It's a question of how when the appeals court heard the case, Jim, they were trying to decide whether or not the two lower tribunals had decided it correctly. Obviously, they felt like it hadn't been. But the standard of review between that appeals court and the Supreme Court, I think, is if I recall some of my teaching correctly, is going to turn on whether or not that the appeals court decision constituted an abuse of discretion in overturning the two previous decisions. In other words, there will be no new evidence taken. It'll be decided strictly on the record that is put before the court. And if I were to go and lay a $20 bill bet, I would bet that the appeals court decision will be overturned. Unless, and of course, we're talking about Illinois courts, Jim, we're talking about Illinois politics. and Illinois politics is something that one would be wise never to bet on.
I think not.
Well, it would not break my back, what Jefferson say about religion? It would neither break my leg nor pick my purse to see Rahm Emanuel not be allowed to run for mayor. At this point, I think he's probably poisoned any chances he has for being elected in the first place.
I should think so.
I mean, I can't imagine who's out there that wants him as mayor of Chicago. Were I a Chicagoan, I wouldn't.
Well, I think that he has as much chance of being elected as mayor of Chicago as Obama does as being reelected president.
Well, I think Obama's chances of being reelected president are actually pretty good.
I don't think so, Bob. Lots of changes. A lot's going to happen in the next 2 years, whatever. I just don't think so. I mean, the guy has just turned on his own base. And he has got.
But you'd never know it by asking the base. You know what his approval rating is among Democrats, Jim? 84%.
Well, maybe so. But I've seen approval ratings drop from 84% one day to 48% the next.
True. But remember what happened with Bill Clinton's approval ratings during the impeachment business. They just kept going up and up and up and up. And the day that the House impeached Bill Clinton, his approval rating was somewhere around 76%.
Yeah, but I don't think there's a valid comparison between the two.
Well, it's the degree to which the American people think that he is being persecuted by the Republicans.
Well.
And I have no doubt in his ability to create and foster that impression. Because he's going to continue doing this middle of the road, shifting to the right, shifting, you know, one step at a time, and the American people are going to be left with the impression that he's done everything he possibly can to appease them. I'm not talking about the teabaggers. The teabaggers are hardcore in their little 20 to 30%.
Yeah, but Bill Clinton evokes a lot of sympathy during that time. How much sympathy has Barack Obama evoked?
But remember, there's still more than a year and a half between now and that election.
Yeah, maybe so. I just don't think Barack Obama has been a good president, and I hope he's not reelected. I'm sorry I voted for him. I had to hold my nose to vote for him in the first place.
Well, just remember, Jim, if he's not reelected, you're going to get Mike Huckabee, Mitt Romney, Michelle Bachmann, Newt Gingrich, Sarah Palin, those are the front runners. Now, I still say that hiding in the weeds is Jeb Bush. And on his worst day, Barack Obama could not possibly be worse than Jeb on his best.
Maybe so, but I don't know. I think that the man has just done a miserable job as being president. He's turned on his own base and going back with all this Reagan hagiography.
That's the part that really just sticks in my throat like a fishbone.
He's not going to win any votes for that. They're just going, like you said earlier in the program tonight, if I recall correctly, they're just looking at him and they know what he's doing. I mean, they're not stupid, and they're not going to be taken in by his references to what a great guy Ronald Reagan was.
Yeah, I see no point in it either, because all it does is serve to piss off people like you and me and much of the Horn family, while at the same time, yeah, I don't think anybody in the right wing has fallen for it.
And I don't think in the long run, when it comes to Election Day, many Democrats are going to fall for it either if he continues to pursue this course. I really don't. But, you know, it's a funny thing. Now the Republicans are going to have, of all people, to respond to his State of the Union address, Bachmann
and Paul Ryan.
That's going to be a real, real...
Oh, I will... No, I'll get the popcorn out and the laughing gas for Bachmann. It's going to... Shoot, I can only... Well, we'll run the State of the Union tomorrow night. And
I've heard the whole things I've heard tonight and all the stuff. It's just a clusterfuck.
Yeah, situation normal.
It's just a great big clusterfuck. That's the way I look at it.
And a couple of other military acronyms as well. FUBAR comes to mind.
I mean, can you think of any word to describe it better?
No. Up beyond all recognition.
See, when you look at the entire spectrum, or as my favorite French expression, a tout de raison of the whole thing, it's just a great big Charlie Foxtrot. It's just a great big Charlie Foxtrot.
Hear, hear. Jim, you have a good evening, my friend.
You too. Stay well, and, you know, keep doing what you're doing.
I'm going to try. Later, Jim. Bye now.
Later, bye.
And for the other folks blinking on hold, my sincere apologies. We will get to you as quick as possible on tomorrow night or a future broadcast. I guess what? State of the Union begins at 8, so we got two hours to talk tomorrow night. Jump in line early, and we'll get there. Time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Got to do this in a hurry, though, because Rick Smith, I believe, is on the way, because Monday Night Football is no more. Thanks for the continuing support of all of you and of the hardest working, bravest people I know.